All right. Well, you've just heard from Niels that light charge rods attract. I'm going to talk about why that is from a theoretical point of view, much simplified theoretical point of view. All the work that I'm going to tell you about today was done by my postdoc, Bae-Yoon Han, who's sitting right there in front of Phil Pinkus. Okay. So we were motivated by a biophysical phenomenon that Vic Bloomfield is going to talk about later in the conference, so I don't want to go into it too much. But the phenomenon is called DNA condensation. And as you learned from Cyrus's talk this morning, the point is that DNA in water is very highly charged, with one negative charge every 1.7 angstroms along its length. Right? So there's this DNA packaging problem that Rudy alluded to. Right? Here's the same picture, in fact. You take this virus, right? You explode. This is an osmotically shocked bacteriophage. You explode it with osmotic shock, and it spills out its DNA, right? And as he said, it would take 100 atmospheres to concentrate all this DNA into the form that it was in the virus before you exploded it. But the virus is pretty clever. It doesn't use 100 atmospheres. What it does is it uses multivalent cationes. So some simple viruses, anyway. Use multivalent cationes. So the idea is you can do this in vitro. You can take DNA in solution, and now you add a multivalent salt where the valency of the positive ion is 3 or higher. Okay? And what you get is these condensed bundles of DNA where the DNA is highly concentrated inside here. Inside the toroids, it's wound around like this, like a garden hose. Okay? And then the rods is wound up and down like this. And it's believed that the packing of the chains, if you look at the cross-section, let me just show a quick picture of that. Turns out the diameter of these toroids, the cross-sectional area, is about the same as the cross-sectional area of the rod-like assemblies. And if you look at the cross-section, it's about 25, 30 chains across. And the spacing between the chains is 25 to 27 angstroms. And DNA itself is 20 angstroms thick. So the spacing, they're very, very tightly packed, very concentrated inside these bundles with perhaps a hexatic packing. Okay, so this phenomenon raises some very interesting questions from a physical point of view. The first question is, well, what is the origin of the attraction that draws these chains together? And to look at that, we're going to just study two infinitely long charged rods, okay? So not, we're going to replace the DNA double helix by just a rod to see where the attraction comes from. But suppose there's an attraction. There is an attraction, of course. Usually when there's attractions, what you would get is phase separation, right? If there's not very much DNA in solution, it will remain dissolved. But if there's too much, then it will phase separate out, get a DNA-rich and a DNA-poor phase. But that's not happening here. You get these bundles of fairly well-defined size. So why is that? So what is limiting the size of the aggregate? And to answer that question, we're going to look at bundles of N rods. Okay. So what got us going in all this, let me just say, it's not just DNA that does this. Here's a picture of bundles of F actin that are bundled by multivalent cationes as well. And that's important in its own right for biological reasons, because there's a network of actin bundles bundled by multivalent cationes that underlies the cell membrane and gives it elasticity. So that's important. And if you can, you can get bundles of other things as well. So FD virus itself is a very long, fairly stiff object that carries a charge. And you can take these FD viruses, and here's a picture from Jay Tang. Of FD virus, you add divalent calcium ions, and they bundle to form these strings. Okay, each string contains hundreds of FD viruses. And you can see, again, there's a fairly well-defined cross-section of these, cross-sectional diameter of these strings. So it's, yes? Oh, they're, well, okay, they're parallel. They're not perfectly lined up end to end. Okay, so this is much longer than a single FD, I think. Yeah, but they're packed in a parallel fashion inside the bundle. Yeah, but their ends are not all lined up together. Okay, So I'm going to talk about some simulations that Niels did, but he didn't talk about. These are the ones that got us going. This was done with Jay Maschel, Robin Brinsman, and Bill Gelbart. So in these simulations, unlike what he talked about just now, they had open system in the x and y directions. Okay, so they were not using periodic boundary conditions in the x and y directions, but they had periodic boundary conditions in the z direction. Okay, is a Brownian dynamics. And these rods were negatively charged, and they put enough counter ions so the whole system was neutral. And they found that the two rods attracted each other when they were very close together in low temperature. Okay, and as was pointed out, actually, this was not the first time that this was seen, but it was the first time we had seen it. And it was interesting to us because mean field theories, like Debye-Huckel theory, or even the nonlinear Poisson-Boltzmann equation, would predict for this geometry that you would always get a repulsion. Okay, and well, this is one audience. I don't have to explain what the Poisson-Boltzmann equation is. But the point is, it is a mean field theory, and if it predicts a repulsion, that is sort of telling us that fluctuations are what are giving you an attraction in the simulation. Okay, so let's see. I should probably introduce the Beerham length. I don't think that has been done yet. So the Beerham length is my favorite length scale. It's the length scale at which the distance between two point charges, a charge E, is equal to kT. Okay, and in water, this is about seven angstroms. So that will come up again and again. So what did they find? Neil sort of flashed these results, but I want to go over them because they're rather remarkable. If the rods are not very strongly charged, they find that the interaction between the two rods is always repulsive. So this is a case where each rod is charged, but only one out of every four monomers along the rod is charged. Okay, so fairly weak charge density along the rods, and the interaction between the two is always repulsive. This is the force as a function of the distance between the two rods. Now they increase the charge density, so now one out of every two monomers is charged, and now you see an attraction. And as the charge density increases further, the attraction gets deeper. So now every monomer is charged. So the more highly charged these rods are, the stronger the attraction. Now, you may think, what's the big deal, right? I have multivalent counter ions. Of course, I could get attractions. And there's this thing called a salt bridge, right? Where, for example, if you have a divalent ion here, it's no surprise it could bring together two monovalent negative charges, right, and tie them together. But it's not just that, because here's the depth of the minimum that they measure, okay, as a function of temperature for monovalent and for divalent ions. And what you see is there's an attraction even when you have monovalent counter ions here, where you would not expect to see this sort of salt bridge. You still see an attraction. It's just not as strong. So as you go to divalent counter ions, it gets stronger. And it turns out for the parameters, the sort of DNA-ish parameters that they're using, this goes away. This attraction goes away before you get to room temperature. Okay, but it is actually there at low enough temperatures. So we need to have a mechanism that could include both cases. All right. Let me spend just a few minutes talking about the idea of counter ion condensation, because that's really key. It's introduced independently by Ozawa and Manning in the late 60s. It's a beautiful idea, and it really comes from the geometry of the charge. So the question is here. Suppose I have an infinitely long negative line charge, okay? And I want to say, where do the counter ions like to hang out? Well, it's the balance between energy and entropy, because energy, right, would like the counter ions to be attracted to the rod. So the counter ions, energy would say the counter ions would like to be near the rod. But entropy would say they would like to explore the entire volume. So to look at this, we're going to confine the rod inside a cylinder of radius r and look at the limit that r goes to infinity and see what happens. Well, when r goes to infinity, the energy of confining these counter ions in the cylinder of radius r goes like the log of r, because it's a line charge. The entropy goes like the log of the concentration, which winds up being log r as well. And so these are balanced as r goes to infinity. This is very different from the case of a spherical charge, right, where as if I take a spherical charge, confine it in a sphere of radius r, big sphere of radius r, the energy would go like 1 over r, the entropy would still go like log r, so the entropy would win as r goes to infinity. So that says a spherical charge would always lose its counter ions at zero concentration, where a line charge can hold on to some of them. All right. So the idea is that because energy and entropy have the same scaling with r, then they can compete with each other, and it depends on temperature. So that at a high enough temperature, all the counter ions are free, entropy wins. But as you lower the temperature, then energy can start confining some of the counter ions near the chain. And those we will call condensed counter ions. So those are the ones that hang out near the chain. And the idea of the two-state model, which is really nice, is that then you can take the counter ions and divide them into two classes, the ones that are free, that are essentially just acting like Debye screening, and the condensed counter ions, which are near the rod. So that is, in fact, the model we'll use. So the idea for the attraction actually goes way back also to Ozawa in 1968 or so. And he said, well, look, suppose we have our condensed counter ions. Here are our condensed counter ions. Okay? Here's our rod. What the condensed counter ions do is they effectively change the local charge. So that if I had a local charge in the absence of a counter ion, just this charge would be minus F0. If I have a counter ion of valence Z, it becomes minus F0 plus Z. And if I have two counter ions nearby, okay, that becomes minus F0 plus 2Z. And then the idea is, right, I've got these random charge variables along this rod that characterize the state of the rod. And then as these counter ions move up and down, or as they exchange as free counter ions, so this one could pop off, another one could pop on, these charge variables will fluctuate. So these are annealed random variables. And that would always lead to attraction, right? Because if I have a fluctuating charge distribution on this rod and one on this rod, then if I bring them close together, they can get correlated. And that will give an attraction very similar to the van der Waals attraction, except that it comes from thermal instead of quantum fluctuations. So that's the basic idea. We made an improvement to the calculation, basically, for two rods over Ozawa's idea. And the main thing is that we got the temperature dependence right. But let me just show you the idea. So how close do they have to be before this attraction comes? Just from this picture, you can already say, well, how the distance at which the two rods have to approach each other in order for this attraction to become important is the distance over which the counter ions on these two rods can become correlated. And that distance is exactly the Biram length, because it's the electrostatic interaction that's correlating them, and it's thermal energy that would like to decorrelate them. So the distance at which they should attract should be the valency squared times the Biram length. So it's a fairly short-range attraction. But we would like to actually calculate the functional form. And the idea is then we just start with Coulomb interactions between all the charges in the system on the two rods, the fluctuating charges. And then the partition function, right, is just the average over all possible charge configurations of the Boltzmann factor. Now, we use an approximation. We don't solve this exactly. And the approximation we use is we do the Hubbard-Chanovich transformation, which basically says we replace these two charge interactions, these Coulomb interactions, with an interaction of a single charge with a potential. Let's call it phi. This potential fluctuates. It depends on where you are, because it comes from the interactions with all the other charges. Then we assume that the fluctuations in this potential are weak compared to kT, and we treat them at the Gaussian level. This is essentially equivalent to doing Debye-Huckel theory, but not ordinary Debye-Huckel theory. Ordinary Debye-Huckel theory would just give a repulsion. This is different because we have a one-dimensional Debye-Huckel theory for the charges on this rod and a 1D Debye-Huckel theory for the charges on this rod, and they interact through a three-dimensional Debye-Huckel theory solution in between. Okay? So it's not your ordinary Debye-Huckel theory.
But Debye-Huckel theory is linear, so superpositional.
That's right. What's not linear about it is that we have, he says Debye-Huckel is linear. That's right. But what's not linear about this, right, is that we have introduced condensed counter ions as another variable. So we have these fluctuating charges here. Okay? That's the nonlinearity. Okay? Yes. Do we lose superposition because we have these fluctuating charge variables on the rods? Okay. So the result of doing this calculation, there are two pieces to the interaction. First of all, there's a repulsion. Where does the repulsion come from? Well, you see, not all of the counterions are condensed. You only have complete condensation at zero temperature. So that means that each rod still carries a net charge. Okay? In other words, if we look at the charge distribution on each monomer, right, each monomer here has a charge distribution and values of the charge that they could assume. This charge distribution has an average value, which is the net charge. Okay? The more counterion condensation there is, the closer this becomes to zero, but it's still negative because not all the counterions are condensed. In addition to that, this charge distribution can be characterized by a variance. All right? And this variance depends on the valency square times the number of condensed counterions per monomer. Yes? Yeah, we solve for it self-consistently as a function of the distance between the two rods. Yeah. So the point is that this is a quantity. How much counterion condensation there is something that you can solve for. Okay. So it's not just fixed. This is
either on the rod or they're off the rod.
That's right. They're either on the rod and changing the local charge, or they're off the rod and screening in a Debye fashion. All right. So the repulsion then is logarithmic, right, in the distance between the two rods R, and it depends on the net charge Q. Whereas the attraction is this piece here, and you can see that it only depends on the variance, delta Q squared. So since the repulsion depends on the mean and the attraction depends on the variance of the charge distribution of these monomers, we can vary the variance relative to the mean by tuning both the amount of counterion condensation, and you see the valence here. As you increase the valence here, the variance becomes bigger and bigger, okay, and then the attraction can overcome the repulsion. So that is basically the mechanism. So if the two rods are far apart, they repel because the charge fluctuations cannot get correlated on the two rods, so it's the repulsion due to the net charge. But if they get close enough together, these two charge fluctuations can become correlated, and that gives you an attraction. So we can plot our results. The great thing about simulations is that they leave off almost as many things as we do. So, for example, water is just a dielectric continuum, of course, with epsilon equals 80. So we can compare to the simulations with no adjustable parameters. And when we do that, our result is this purple curve. The simulations are these points. Okay, and you can see we get the range of the interaction just right. And as I said, what you would expect is the range of the interaction to be z squared, the valency squared, times the Biram length. This is for divalent counterions, so that would be about 30. And it's actually quite a bit shorter than that. That's the value of actually doing a calculation.
Do you also represent temperature dependent?
Yes. It gets stronger as you go to lower temperatures. Just like in the
temperature goes to zero, fluctuations die.
Yes, but they become more correlated. You see, as you go to lower and lower if you go to lower and lower temperatures, the charge on this becomes more and more correlated to the charge across. You can start thinking about it at very low temperatures as an ionic crystal on this chain. Excuse me. You can think of it. You can think of it at low temperatures. Okay. I'll get to it later.
Yes.
The what?
Axial correlation for plots.
Yes, I have charge correlations, which I will show later.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. If it goes on the scale of the Biram length, then it gets further out, the temperature goes up. Does that correspond to the
temperature dependence actually crosses over to something else at very low temperatures. So it's more complicated than just the Biram length, as you can see from the form of the expression, actually. So it's not quite as simple as that. Yes. What? Yeah. Yeah. It's a mess. The main point, the idea to show this was just to show that we did it. rather than to convey any deeper information. All right, so we know now where the attraction comes from. Let me just go back to the original question, which I've lost, which is what sets the bundle size, right? Because if we have an attraction, what we would expect this to give eventually is just phase separation, and that's not what's happening. So what we need to do now is to look at bundles of N rods. And now we have this result for the two rods. We can look at that. So we're going to study a bundle of N rods. Okay, we'll just put them on a lattice and see what should happen. Well, what would we expect based on the two-rod calculation? We have a short-range attraction, and we have a long-range repulsion. And when you put those two together, what you get, in fact, is if you plot the free energy as a function of the number of rods in the bundle, you get a minimum. Let me just explain the reasoning. If you have an attraction, we have a very short-range attraction, so each rod is interacting basically with its neighbors. So the attractive contribution to the energy has a minus sign because it's attractive, and it should scale linearly with the number of rods. Whereas we have a long-range repulsion, so every rod is repelling every other rod, so that goes like n squared, number of pairs. And that gives you a minimum, which is great. We're done. Except that this reasoning is completely wrong. Okay? Why is it wrong? Because it assumes that we can take the two-rod result and apply it to a many-rod system. And the two-rod and the rod interactions are not pairwise additive. Okay.
You're also dealing with counter-rods, which completed a lot of
stress. Well, that's what gives us... Yeah. Okay. But this is the basic idea. Even with the counter-ions, if you use pairwise additivity of the two-rod results, you would still get a preferred bundle size. You would still get a minimum. Okay, so what's wrong with this? We assume pairwise additivity of the effective counter-ion-mediated interactions between the two rods. And that's not right, because if I have a fluctuating charge distribution on this rod, another one on this rod, okay, they adjust, they get correlated, they're happy. Now I bring up a third rod, that's going to affect the charge distribution on these two, right? So the interaction cannot possibly be pairwise additive. In fact, if you do, it's customary when you show results to always show the leading brand. I should show the leading brand here. It turns out if you treat the interaction between the two rods within a multipole expansion, okay, so you start with the two rods very far away and bring them together, you can also get an attraction just within the first term in the multipole expansion, which we would call the dipole monopole approximation. And that's what people had done before. All right. But that's actually not legal in the regime where you have attractions, because as soon as they're close enough for them to get attracted, the multipole expansion diverges. So truncating the multipole expansion at first or second order is really illegal. I forgot to explain that. Thank you. D is the distance at which we just plunge down the simulations. Turn around and the interaction becomes repulsive again. Why is that? At this point D, the counterions actually get squeezed out in between the two rods to the hardcore interaction. We don't have that, so ours just keeps going down. Okay, once the counterions can no longer fit between the two rods, you see a repulsion. We could put that in by hand, but it's not worth it because it's such a non-universal thing. Okay, so we're only trying to get the range of the attraction right. Yeah. All right, so actually, if you treat this system within this dipole-monopole approximation, you would get pairwise additive interactions, but that's illegal. So you have to sum up the whole multipole expansion, and that means interactions are not pairwise additive, which means that if we want to study the N-rod system, we have to do it explicitly. No cheating. So it turns out that we can do that, though. If we put the rods on a lattice, we can actually solve with the N-rod system, we can get a closed form expression for the free energy. Oh, this is where I get to flash up that horrible looking result again. This attraction, it has the form of the integral over the wave vector in the z direction of the logarithm of something. This turns out to be the logarithm of the determinant of a 2 by 2 matrix. If we're doing an N rod system, this becomes the log of the determinant of an n by n matrix. So we can express both the repulsion and the attraction in terms of n by n matrices in closed form. And then for small enough n, we can solve this numerically. For large n, it turns out we can treat it numerically. So that's the explicit calculation for n rods. Let me show you what we get. So this is what you would predict based on pairwise additivity, right? There should be a minimum here. What we get instead is this. Just keeps going down and down and down. In other words, the preferred bundle size is infinite in this case. It wants to make an infinitely large bundle. In other words, it would just like to phase separate. It's like any other attraction, just like the van der Waals attraction. You add more. We're not including the entropy of the rods here. As you add more particles, it just, the free energy just goes down, and it's extensive. It's linear in n as it should be. If you add too much salt, by the way, this is what happens. If you add too much salt, then it looks like this. The minimum is here. They want to be just isolated rods, so they repel each other. So by adding too much monovalent salt, you can dissolve the bundle. All right. What is a one way to look at this result? One is by these fluctuations. Another way to look at it is that at very low temperatures, this is an attraction that gets stronger as we lower the temperature. At very low temperatures, what we expect is an ionic crystal, right? And our version of the ionic crystal is not quite the right one because we put the counterions on the rods. So our version of the ionic crystal looks something like this. Okay, in reality, the counterions are in between the rods, crystallizing. So what happens at higher temperatures? Well, at higher temperatures, we can calculate the charge correlations both in this direction and also in this direction, okay, and see what they look like. So let me show you. So at high temperatures, if you look in the z direction, if you have a charge here, then some distance away you tend not to have a charge, and then you tend to have a charge and then not to have one. Okay, so the charge correlations are oscillatory, but they're within this decaying envelope. And it's very similar, actually, to charge correlations in Debye-Hückel solutions and electrolyte solutions that Ben Lee and Michael Fisher worked on, where you can eventually see as you lower the temperature, this decay length diverges, okay, and it approaches an ionic crystal. Because an ionic crystal would be these oscillations would continue forever. If you can also look not only in the z direction, but you can look at charge correlations from one rod to the next. And this is what they look like. If you do the illegal thing and truncate the multipole expansion, it's just monotonic. But if you sum up all terms of the multipole expansion, which is what we've done, what you get is something that looks like this. It oscillates. So if you look at one rod, and then you go over to the next rod at the same height, okay, you tend to have plus, minus going across. And it's correlated way out here to about 15 rods away inside the bundle. So it's a very long-range correlation. These are at the sort of DNA-ish parameters that we're talking about. And so this is not an ionic crystal, right, because these correlations decay. But in a way, it's a precursor to the ionic crystal, and that gives us some insight into why the bundle size would really like to be infinite, because no one's surprised that an ionic crystal wants to be infinite. Okay, so we were very happy. We did this nice calculation. We found that electrostatics favor infinite bundles. And this is not what you would get just from the back of the envelope pairwise additive calculation. So we had really done something, except we remembered the experimental result, which is that you get these well-defined bundles, you know, with a very well-defined size here. So our calculation is contradicting now the experimental results. So the question is why? We're still left with the question, what is setting the size of the aggregate? Well, there are various possibilities. One could be that it has nothing to do with electrostatics at all. Stella Park and Bill Gelbart have a very nice theory for toroids that argue that topological defects involved in winding the chains into a toroid could limit the size. So it might not have anything to do with electrostatics. It might have something to do with some physics that we've left out. For example, that there's some the DNA is actually chiral. There's some twist. There's a helical twist. So although they're hexagonally packed, there's some helical twist, and maybe that introduces something. So they're not perfectly parallel rods. But there's another way out, which is what I'm going to talk about, which has to do with the kinetics of bundle formation. Because what we would like is a very generic explanation that could apply not only to the toroids, but also to the rod-like bundles, and also to those bundles of FD virus that I showed you, right? And the only common denominator in all these systems is the electrostatics. So we would like to argue that the electrostatics affect the kinetics of bundle formation, and that, in fact, the kinetics are what are setting this size. So what are the usual kinetics? The usual thing that you get, right, when you're trying to phase separate is nucleation and growth. So here's the free energy of my n-rod bundle as a function of number of rods. And what you usually get is something like this. The free energy goes up if the number of rods is fairly small, and then you overcome this nucleation barrier, and then you just fall down. And there's no barrier to subsequent growth. Once you've overcome the barrier, you just keep growing, and there's no barrier to that. Obviously, that would be a problem if we had this situation to explain the experimental results, because they're stopping at some size. So where does this nucleation barrier come from? Let me just remind you, right? If you have this n-rod bundle, when you make this bundle, you're gaining the bulk free energy, because they like to be together. On the other hand, you have to pay the cost of this interface, and that scales like n to the 1/2. So for small enough n, you end up actually paying free energy because of the interface, and it's only when the bulk free energy can overcome the interfacial free energy that you start falling down here. Well, in our case, it turns out that this interfacial free energy is negligible. And you could actually see that because I showed you the free energy as a function of the number of rods, and it just went straight down. In other words, once you have two rods, you've already overcome that nucleation barrier. Okay, so that the interfacial tension is really, really small for our system. There's another kind of nucleation barrier. For a torus, you actually have to nucleate a loop. Okay, so you have to nucleate this loop, and then the toroids can start growing. So there, you could argue there is some kind of nucleation barrier, but that still would not give us a well-defined size. What we need is, in fact, a barrier to subsequent growth. Unlike the usual case where there's no barrier to growth once you've overcome the nucleation barrier, here we need a barrier to growth that increases as the bundle size increases. And we actually have that, and let me show you where it comes from. I'm going to generalize a little bit. Up to now, I've only been talking about infinitely long rods, and they've been perfectly parallel. Now I'm going to talk about two finite rods, and I'm going to let them tilt relative to each other. So I'm going to consider two rods like this. Let's let them be initially parallel. And then I'll just tilt this one towards you with an angle theta. Okay? And I'm going to look at the interaction, the free energy between the two rods, as a function of the distance between the rods and this angle theta. What does it look like? Here's a picture. I hope this works. All right, here's the free energy as a contour plot in the r theta plane, okay? So this is where the two rods are perpendicular to each other. Here they're parallel, here they're close together, and here they're far apart. And the free energy goes from, this is actually backwards, violet is low energy and red is high energy, okay? So they're, this, okay. So let's look at what happens when they're far apart, way out here. Okay? When they're far apart, as you bring them closer together, that's moving this way. That's moving this way. Let me hold them far apart and just change the angle. That's what I want to do first. Okay. So if I hold them far apart and I change the angle, I start with them parallel and make them perpendicular, the free energy just drops monotonically. It goes from red to this sort of sickly green here. All right. So what's happening? As I hold them parallel and now I tilt them, right, that the when they're far apart, there's only a repulsion between the two rods because the charge fluctuations are not correlated. They're too far apart. And so there's only a repulsion, and so the free energy goes down if I tilt them to be perpendicular, which makes sense because the charges are further apart. And, all right, so far away, they would like to be perpendicular. Now what happens is if I get closer? Well, if I get closer, okay, let's look over here, right? Then actually there's a barrier. Because if they're parallel, it's happy, right? If they're parallel, the charge fluctuations are correlated and there's an attraction. As I tilt a small angle away from parallel, the charge fluctuations cannot get correlated as well. So the attraction goes away. So the free energy goes up. And so it goes from blue to yellow. Okay, it's going up. But as I keep going, it goes down again. Okay, the free energy goes down. Why does it go down? That's because once the angle is too great, right, the fluctuation, correlation, attraction is essentially gone, and all they see is the repulsion, and then they would like to be perpendicular. So there's actually a barrier in between. So if they're perpendicular, they're close together, they're not correlated. If I tilt it away from perpendicular, the free energy goes up. But if they're parallel, they're happy. And if I tilt away from parallel, the free energy also goes up. So that says that there's a barrier at some intermediate angle. So the free energy... Okay. The appropriate length for the rod should be really the persistence length of the DNA. And that's what we did for this calculation. Okay. This was just two rods. Yes. That's right. Yes. Yes. It is. It is. I'll make it clear why. It depends actually on the cross-sectional diameter, which is the number of rods you have in cross-section, which actually doesn't depend on the length. Because if a single chain comes through this cross-section twice, it's counted twice. You see what I'm saying? So if you look at the cross-section of this bundle, how many chains are going across? And that's what it turns out to depend on. All right. So our free energy looks like this as a function of angle. It's happy at 90 degrees because of the repulsion. And if they're close enough together, it's happy at 0 degrees because of the attraction. But there's a barrier in between. Now, in order to show that the kinetics can actually limit the bundle thickness, we have to show three things. First of all, we have to show that the barrier height, which is this, okay, can exceed KT. Then we have to be able to show that the barrier height also depends on the bundle thickness, right? And we have to show that this barrier angle, the position of the barrier, does not increase with thickness, because if it increases with thickness, if it goes to pi over 2, then any angle will just fall into this minimum, right? So it's only angles that are smaller than theta 0 where it can fall into the minimum and get trapped into the bundle. Because if you're on this side of the barrier, right, you would like to fall down on this side. You see a repulsion. You go down to 90 degrees, and you only see a repulsion, so you'd like to move away. It's only if you're close enough to parallel that you would fall down this side of the barrier. You would tilt towards parallel and feel the attraction and come in. So what we need to do is we need to look at what happens when we bring one rod up to an N by N bundle of rods. So I have this N by N bundle, and now I'm going to bring this one rod up to it at some distance r and some angle theta. So what happens to the barrier height and position? Well, it turns out the position of the barrier is nearly independent of the number of rods. What this does, this angle... This is the furthest angle that you can tilt away from parallel and still feel the attraction. This basically goes like 1 over the length of the rod. And for the persistence length of DNA, if you work out the numbers, it turns out to be 7 degrees. All right. I wouldn't take that number too seriously. The height of the barrier turns out to increase linearly with the diameter. Why is that? Because, remember, this rod is repelled by the bundle. This rod is carrying a net charge. The bundle is carrying a net charge. As the bundle gets bigger, it's more repelled by the bundle. And what it's repelled by is the face of the bundle that it sees. So the cross-sectional area of the bundle. That scales with the diameter, N. Okay, so you've got a barrier height that scales with the diameter of the bundle. And since you have that, you can always then get the barrier height to exceed KT. That's no problem. You just make the diameter big enough. For our numbers, it turns out to be a diameter of about 40, which is high. On the other hand, I should tell you that we're doing this approximation where we put all the charges on the rod at the center. And for DNA, which is 20 angstroms thick, you should really put them at the surface. When you do that, the repulsion goes up, and that increases the barrier. So we have an underestimate of the barrier, which would translate into an overestimate of the size of the bundle. Yes?
In here, the number of persistence left for DNA, the number of rods.
So it's the cross section. So it's.
The bundle is N rods across.
The bundle is N rods across if I just look at the cross section, right? Where's my picture of the cross section? My cross section looks like this. Okay? Right. N squared is the number of rods. All right. So that's the picture. If I have this huge bundle, then the barrier is larger than KT. So if I'm far away, what do I feel? I feel a repulsion. If I start out parallel, so suppose I start out in the best case, which is that I'm parallel to the bundle, and now I'm approaching, this rod is approaching the bundle. Well, if that's the case, it's going to feel this repulsion when it's far away, and that's going to rotate it to be perpendicular. It's going to feel a torque, and then it's going to move away because it feels a repulsion. It's only if it somehow manages to get very close to this bundle and very parallel to it that it will feel the attraction at all and will manage to join the bundle, even though that is the equilibrium state. It would be happier, the free energy would be lower if it could join it, but it has to overcome this huge barrier to do that. Yes, okay. In principle, can go underneath and then sort of zip up. Mark Stevens, I don't know if you're going to show a movie which shows something like that, that you see two rods that are sort of parallel to each other and they start out not in registry and then they sort of move up and zip together. It's really neat. Okay. It's a very, very short-range attraction, remember. It's almost a contact attraction. So it has to get very, very close and also very parallel to it. A few angstroms, 7 angstroms. That's right. That's right. Oh, okay. The question was, how close does it have to get to the bundle in order to be caught by it, to feel the attraction? And the answer is, it has to get within, say, 5-7 angstroms of the bundle before it feels the attraction, and it has to be parallel to it in order for it to get caught. So this is a very unusual kind of kinetics. I don't know of any other system where that's like this, because remember, we have a short-range attraction, a long-range repulsion. In spite of that, the equilibrium bundle size wants to be infinite. That's because the interaction is not pairwise additive. But the fact that there's a long-range repulsion is extremely important to the kinetics, give you this increasing kinetic barrier. So even though it wants to make an infinite bundle, it can never, ever get there because the kinetics don't allow it. I just wanted to show you a preview of Mark Stevens' talk. Here's a bundle. A fairly rigid chains. They're changed by these red guys. But you see the blue counter ions that are sort of gluing it together. This is a bit of a cheat. It's really four images of the same thing. So you just look at the square. Okay. So you can see it's trying to make a bundle. The more generic thing is this is if you have more of them, you tend to get a network of bundles rather than these nice toroids and rod-like structures that you get for DNA. So the actual shape of these is something that we have not explained. All we have tried to explain is the size. So let me just remind you again that the calculations were all done by Bay and Ha, and I'll stop there.
I've had plenty of time for discussion and plenty of questions. Why not start at the back for one?
Yeah, at this, I should say that at this, at the short distances that we're talking about, where this attraction is important, there are all sorts of other mechanisms that come into play. For example, van der Waals interactions and all sorts of things. The important thing, though, is to realize that this attraction has to be important because van der Waals alone plus the repulsion would not give you the attraction. Yeah. No, the evidence is that they can move along the DNA up and down, and they can move in and out. Yeah, they're not so close that they're really stuck. Yeah. Yes.
Maybe the number of DNA rods that just the statistics could overcome.
Yeah, what this picture would get, let me make it clear, what this picture would give is sort of a two-stage process. There's an initial very fast growth of the bundles until the barrier height gets to be several KT. Right? And then from then on, there's very slow growth. And if they don't make these beautiful bundles, if they make more messy structures instead, it's easy to see that you could sort of circumvent this and then precipitate. Yeah.
Talk about this ionic crystal.
Yeah.
So all the lattices, you have square lattices, right?
We've actually done it on a hexagonal lattice also. The hexagonal lattice is more stable.
It is?
Yeah,
okay.
It is actually more stable,
so
slightly.
Talk about that
because of the frustration. Yeah, there's this problem of frustration, right? If you have three rods in a triangle, and then you have the counterions on the rods, then you have this plus, minus, and then you can say on this corner it should be plus or minus. So there's a problem of frustration in our case, which is because we put the counterions on the rods. In the real system, of course, the counterions can go in between the rods, and that relieves the frustration. And even with the frustration, we find that the hexagonal lattice is more stable. Which is not something we would have guessed. What?
It's an intrinsically fluctuating result you're dealing with.
That's right.
So it's not
so surprising that frustration doesn't kill us. Yes.
What is the role of flexibility? In order for the feeling of first to be parallel, they have to use trade. And you're arguing with the role of flexibility.
Flexibility is extremely important. It's very important that these rods. That these chains are stiff, quite stiff, that the persistence length is long, so that they are parallel over some distance, which is the persistence length. The reason why is because these fluctuation attractions, they not only lead to attractions between chains, but they lead to attractions within the chain, right? So that will tend to collapse the chain. And that was shown very beautifully by simulation several years ago by Mark Stevens and Kurt Kramer, where as they increased the barium length, first the chain repels itself and gets bigger, but then eventually you get counterion condensation and then it starts shrinking again, and eventually if there's too much it actually becomes smaller than the neutral chain. So you can get these attractions that end up collapsing the chain. And this I can show you, I'm sort of showing all of Mark's nice pictures. You'll see them again. But here's what happens when you have a bunch of more flexible chains. They just collapse into a mess. Okay.
Well, it's just a comment. Purely bifocal will not give you that drug.
That's right.
Combined with something like the name of Michael Yermak and Dave.
That's right.
And you do get attraction.
That's right. So pure bifocal does not give attractions. Once you have this two-state model that introduces the nonlinearity, then you get the attractions. Oh, yes, absolutely. The chains have to be sufficiently highly charged in order for you to see the attraction. And the reason why is because if they're not highly charged enough, and that was these curves that I showed you from the simulation at the beginning, the more highly charged they were, the stronger attraction got. The reason for that is as they become more highly charged, you have more counterion condensation. And remember, the variance in the distribution goes like the amount of counterion condensation times z squared. So the more you have to have counter-ion condensation, you have to have enough of it for the attractions to be able to overcome the repulsion due to the net charge.
But you can calculate the critical charge density that you have to have on the polyion.
Exactly. Yes. Yes, we basically have that. They have to be strongly charged enough for the attractions to be, as there's more condensation, as they become more highly charged, there are two things. First, the net charge goes down, so the repulsion gets smaller and the attraction gets larger. So there's a critical threshold for that, for you to, for the attraction.
Yeah. Two. One, two, three, four, five.
Okay.
Two questions.
It's okay, I have 7 minutes.
So the first one is the sodium, which you said also gives rise to bubbling. I can't see how you can get anything better than zero minus, you can get zero. But I can't say you can get pluses in your model. And, that could certainly, that correlation could certainly reduce repulsion. I don't see how it could attract. The other question is very short, and that is, why don't you
No, the bundle itself does not have to be neutral. The bundle is sitting in solution. The whole solution has to be neutral. But the bundle itself does not have to be neutral. Now, of course, the larger it gets, the closer to neutral it gets.
And
yes. And the first question was, if you have a monovalent counterion, then you can't have the overcharging, so you couldn't get a plus one charge along the chain locally. You would either have zero or minus one.
Right, but you said that still was the case.
You can still get an attraction. It's just a question of where. Now, the point is, right, is that these fluctuations still give an attraction. It's just smaller. Think of the zero minus as a dipole with an offset. It's a dipole with an offset. So you can get the dipole attractions. At zero temperature, you get an ionic crystal, and it's completely neutral. That's it. Zero, 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 zero. Yes, yes, yes. Of course, remember you can get more than one counter ion per monomer, as well. Our model, it's the ones that how many are close to this monomer. So if you have two that are close to this monomer, even monovalent counter ions, you could get overcharging. Yeah.
Can you comment on your bundles, the effect of ionic strength from the size of the bundle? Because in principle, everything should be cut off at the bundle, and your bundle is pretty much thicker.
That's right. That's right. Because the attractions, remember, are what are holding the thing together. And the rods inside the bundle, the spacing between the rods in the bundle is only about 7 angstroms.
That's no problem. The question is the size of the bundle. Because your explanation of the size
was this barrier, right. So the size of the bundle is set by the height of the barrier. And now the question is, how does the height of the barrier depend on the amount of salt?
Right, but to get the height of the barrier above PT, you need to have this front of your bundle to have tens of angstroms or hundreds of angstroms across. That's how you get your large M. Because the bilength is much smaller than that, you don't even see the size. When the rod comes in, it doesn't even see all of those. It sees the volume of that.
Right. And the point is, though, there's something about this barrier that's a little bit tricky, which is that as you add salt, you're reducing the repulsions, but you're reducing the attractions even more. So you're screening the attractions even more than you're screening the repulsions. And remember, there's an attraction plus a repulsion that gives you the barrier.
Yeah, I don't
okay.
Really,
so it's not.
How does Rod know about the size of the bundle if the bundle is much bigger than the screening
line? Right. You're saying, I've got this rod, I've got this cross sectional area, this cross section. If this cross sectional diameter is much larger than screening length, how can I see the whole
thing?
How do I see the whole thing? Right. I think it is really a question of. And when you increase the amount of salt, it is a little bit tricky, but you're not only interacting with the ones here, but you're acting with ones that are inside. And you can go, and it's a question of, you see, how far, this is in theta, but how close do you get to the bundle before you see the barrier is also determined by the Debye length. All right, so once you're close enough, you're within a Debye length of the closest rod, you're also within a Debye length of the next rod over because that's only 7 angstroms away. In other words, it's a whole bunch of rods that are nearby. Now the question is, do you see this whole thing?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In our calculations, we see it. That's a good point I hadn't thought of. But in our calculations, we certainly see, even for salt, that it still increases linearly with N. Why? I have to think.
This will be a question addressed to you and to Victor, and it will answer partially later. But if we come back to DNA and remember which ions cause its condensation, in the whole type of biological, if you call them multivalent ions or the not multivalent,
like spermine, spermidine,
yeah.
Polylysine.
Polylysine, some other polyamine. All basically polymers of plus one charges. And the old stuck. Though the old stuck, it may in certain situations not know what they are.
They're mobile.
Yeah, that depends on the time scale you're talking about.
Yes.
Because the energy of interaction in the binding site for these species is much larger than MPC.
But we don't care about time scales. We're doing equilibrium.
Yeah, I
understand. Yeah.
And there are certain examples which are also interesting to remember with this polyamine. There were several papers when positive plus one on those polyamines were separated by different spaces, different length spaces. And some of them in good condensation, some of them don't. That's something to remember. If we come back to more simple ions, there are very few which cause the cobalt
My understanding was that every multivalent counterion that was trivalent or higher that had been tried gave condensation. That's not correct?
No.
Victor, isn't that right?
There are no simple trivalent methyl ions, none, which give covalent interactions. Right.
Yeah, that's totally different. Yeah. Okay, fine. Let me explain. First of all, all right.
So, out of violence we know, I'm just trying to remember to remind you about an experiment. There's cobalt hexane, which is relative, for example, and there are some transition methyl ions, divalent transition methyl ions, which are not quite as bad as trivalent. With cobalt hexane, whoever you ask, you get different answers, whether it's stuck or not. Right? Some people will say, but I guess again, almost everybody would agree that when cobalt hexamine binds M7 and GC base pairs and forms hydrogen bonds with phosphate, its interaction is over 20 kV with its surrounding. So its binding energy is again much larger than 10 kV. If you talk about divalent transition methyl ions, those are mobile. And there's enough evidence for them that they're not that strong, but they cause DNA condensation at elevated temperatures. You have to heat it up to induce DNA.
Right, to get the waters off.
What's your answer?
Yeah, the short answer is, I talk about fluctuations. I talk about fluctuations. That's a high temperature picture. You could also talk about an ionic crystal. That's a low temperature picture. Now there's really a continuum in between. At low temperatures, it makes more sense to talk about forming an ionic crystal. At high temperatures, it makes more sense to talk about correlated fluctuations. But there's really a continuum in between, and the mechanism essentially is this ionic crystal at low temperatures. Remember, this is an attraction that's getting stronger as you go to lower temperatures. At higher temperatures, the sort of DNA-ish temperatures we're talking about, it makes more sense to talk about fluctuations. But if you have something that's stuck, you can still get an ionic crystal. There's no problem. Okay? It's just that the language that I use to describe it is maybe not the best language, but the physics is the same.
Okay, time is really up, but I took three more persons on my internal list. I mean,
we started late.
It's a break moment. Now, so I mean, if you want to have your whatever, I mean, but I think we, but very brief, very short question. Alexei first.
I have a very short comment, though.
So then my answer is really short.
When you see the DNA as a continuously charged cylinder, then the whole key flow is going to counterion. How they see how they will adjust each other to provide attraction. If you consider the helices as discrete objects with helical symmetry of the phosphate, in that case you get a lot of attraction from the adjustment, angular adjustment of this helices.
Yes.
And when you have angular-dependent interaction, you will have a mechanism for which you will get a lot of frustrations. Two molecules can adjust each other, but in a bundle it will be a problem. So you will gain torsional defects, and that will may determine you the size of the bundle.
That could be another mechanism for limiting the bundle. Yeah.
Next question, okay. Sure.
I can wait for the break.
Of course. Last question.
Yeah, I have a very simple question, actually very related to Sergei's question. When you're talking about bundles, you're talking about viruses, right? Is that true? Or
DNA or viruses or F-actin,
right,
they all bundle.
Really common, very well characterized bundles, right? They're
yeah, they all do.
They never change.
Yeah.
I have difficulty in seeing how you're going to do that with. You know, I believe your whole thing, but the limiting factor must be something.
Do you hear down there the question? Or
no.
Can you repeat that, summarize, and give a brief answer?
He's saying he can understand my mechanism for DNA, but he's doubtful whether it applies to an FD virus. The main thing is that the charge is on the surface. We, of course, our calculation directly does not apply to an FD virus because we put the charge at the center of the rod. Okay, we've done now since calculations where we put the charge on the surface of the rod, and then you can still get attractions even when they're very thick,
yeah,
in the case of FD. Well, we'll talk more during the break.
Okay, so let's collect here at half past.